history is full of successfully bold females. There are two main forms of feminine boldness. In the first, more traditional form, the coquettish woman stirs male desire, is completely in control, then at the last minute, after bringing her victim to a boil, steps back and lets him make the bold move. She sets it up, then signals with her eyes, her gestures, that she is ready for him. Courtesans have used this method throughout history. It's how Cleopatra worked on Antony, how Josephine seduced Napoleon, how La Belle Otero amassed a fortune during the Belle Epoque. It lets the man maintain his masculine illusions, although the woman is really the aggressor. The second form of feminine boldness doesn't bother with such illusions. The woman simply takes charge, initiates the first kiss, pounces on her victim. This is how Marguerite de Valois, Louis-Andrea Salomé, and Madame Mao operated, and many men find it not emasculating at all, but very exciting. It all depends on the insecurities and proclivities of the victim. This kind of feminine boldness has its allure because it is more rare than the first kind, but then all boldness is somewhat rare. A bold move will always stand out compared to the usual treatment afforded by the tepid husband, the timid lover, the hesitant suitor. That is how you want it. If everyone were bold, boldness would quickly lose its allure. Reversal. If two people come together by mutual consent, that is not a seduction. There is no reversal. Chapter 24. Beware the After Effects. Danger follows in the aftermath of a successful seduction. After emotions have reached a pitch, they often swing in the opposite direction, toward lassitude, distrust, disappointment. Beware of the long, drawn-out goodbye. Insecure, the victim will cling and claw, and both sides will suffer. If you are to part, make the sacrifice swift and sudden. If necessary, deliberately break the spell you have created. If you are to stay in a relationship, beware a flagging of energy, a creeping familiarity that will spoil the fantasy. If the game is to go on, a second seduction is required. Never let the other person take you for granted. Use absence, create pain and conflict to keep the seduced on tenterhooks. Disenchantment. Seduction is a kind of spell, an enchantment. When you seduce, you're not quite your normal self. Your presence is heightened. You are playing more than one role. You are strategically concealing your tics and insecurities. You have deliberately created mystery and suspense to make the victim experience a real-life drama. Under your spell, the seduced gets to feel transported away from the world of work and responsibility. You will keep this going for as long as you want or can, heightening the tension, stirring the emotions until the time finally comes to complete the seduction. After that, disenchantment almost inevitably sets in. The release of tension is followed by a letdown of excitement, of energy, that can even materialize as a kind of disgust directed at you by your victim, even though what is happening is really a natural emotional course. It is as if a drug were wearing off, allowing the target to see you as you are and being disappointed by the flaws that are inevitably there. On your side, you too have probably tended to idealize your targets somewhat, and once your desire is satisfied, you may see them as weak. After all, they have given in to you. You too may feel disappointed. Even in the best of circumstances, you're dealing now with the reality rather than the fantasy, and the flames will slowly die down, unless you start up a second seduction. You may think that if the victim is to be sacrificed, none of this matters, but sometimes your effort to break off the relationship will inadvertently revive the spell for the other person, causing him or her to cling to you tenaciously. No, in either direction, sacrifice or the integration of the two of you into a couple, You must take disenchantment into account. There is an art to the post-seduction as well. Master the following tactics to avoid undesired after-effects. Fight against inertia. The sense that you're trying less hard is often enough to disenchant your victims. Reflecting back on what you did during the seduction, they will see you as manipulative. You wanted something then, and so you worked at it, but now you are taking them for granted. After the first seduction is over, then show that it isn't really over, that you want to keep proving yourself, focusing your attention on them, luring them. That is often enough to keep them enchanted. Fight the tendency to let things settle into comfort and routine. Stir the pot, even if that means a return to inflicting pain and pulling back. Never rely on your physical charms. Even beauty loses its appeal with repeated exposure. Only strategy and effort will fight off inertia. Maintain mystery. Familiarity is the death of seduction. If the target knows everything about you, the relationship gains a level of comfort but loses the elements of fantasy and anxiety. Without anxiety and a touch of fear, the erotic tension is dissolved. Remember, reality is not seductive. Keep some dark corners in your character. Flout expectations. Use absences to fragment the clinging, possessive pull that allows familiarity to creep in. Maintain some mystery or be taken for granted. You will have only yourself to blame for what follows. Maintain lightness. Seduction is a game, not a matter of life and death. There will be a tendency in the post phase to take things more seriously and personally and to whine about behavior that doesn't please you. Fight this as much as possible, for it will create exactly the effect you don't want. You cannot control the other person by nagging and complaining. It will make them defensive, exacerbating the problem. You will have more control if you maintain the proper spirit. Your playfulness, the little ruses you employ to please and delight them, your indulgence of their faults, will make your victims compliant and easy to handle. Never try to change your victims. Instead, induce them to follow your lead. Avoid the slow burnout. Often, one person becomes disenchanted but lacks the courage to make the break. Instead, he or she withdraws inside. As an absence, this psychological step back may inadvertently reignite the other person's desire, and a frustrating cycle begins of pursuit and retreat. Everything unravels slowly. Once you feel disenchanted and know it is over, end it quickly, without apology. That would only insult the other person. A quick separation is often easier to get over. It's as if you had a problem being faithful, as opposed to your feeling that the seduced was no longer being desirable. Once you're truly disenchanted, there is no going back, so don't hang on out of false pity. It is more compassionate to make a clean break. If that seems inappropriate or too ugly, then deliberately disenchant the victim with anti-seductive behavior. Examples of sacrifice and integration. Number 1. In the 1770s, the handsome Chevalier de Belroche began an affair with an older woman, the Marquise de Merteuil. He saw a lot of her, but soon she began to pick quarrels with him. Entranced by her unpredictable moods, he worked hard to please her, showering her with attention and tenderness. Eventually, the quarreling stopped, and as the days went by, de Belroche felt confident that Merteuil loved him, until one day when he came to visit and found that she wasn't at home. Her footman greeted him at the door and said he would take the Chevalier to a secret house of Merteuil's outside Paris. There, the Marquise was waiting for him in a renewed mood of coquettishness. She acted as if this were their first tryst. The Chevalier had never seen her so ardent. He left at daybreak, more in love than ever, but a few days later they quarreled again. The Marquise seemed cold after that, and he saw her flirt with another man at a party. He felt horribly jealous, but as before, his solution was to become more attentive and loving. This, he thought, was the way to appease a difficult woman. Now, Merteuil had to spend a few weeks at her country home to handle some business there. She invited de Belleroche to join her for an extended stay, and he happily agreed, remembering the new life an earlier stay there had brought to their affair. Once again, she surprised him. Her affection and desire to please him were rejuvenated. This time, though, he didn't have to leave the next morning. Days went by, and she refused to entertain any guests. The world would not intrude on them, and this time there was no coldness or quarreling, only good cheer and love. Yet now de Belleroche began to grow a little tired of the Marquise. He thought of Paris and the balls he was missing. A week later, he cut short his stay on some business pretext and hurried back to the city. Somehow, the Marquise did not seem so charming anymore. Interpretation. The Marquise de Merteuil, a character in Chaudherlot de Laclos's novel Dangerous Liaisons, is a practiced seductress who never lets her affairs drag on too long. De Belleroche is young and handsome, but that is all. As her interest in him wanes, she decides to bring him to the secret house to try to inject some novelty into the affair. This works for a while, but it isn't enough. The Chevalier must be gotten rid of. She tries coldness, anger, hoping to start a fight, even a show of interest in another man. All this only intensifies his attachment. She can't just leave him. He might become vengeful or try even harder to win her back. The solution? She deliberately breaks the spell by overwhelming him with attention. Abandoning the pattern of alternating warmth with coldness, she acts hopelessly in love. Alone with her day after day with no space to fantasize, he no longer sees her as enchanting and breaks off the affair. This was her goal all along. If a break with the victim is too messy or difficult, or you lack the nerve, then do the next best thing. Deliberately break the spell that ties him or her to you. Aloofness or anger will only stir the other person's insecurity, producing a clinging horror. Instead, try suffocating them with love and attention. Be clinging and possessive yourself. Moon over the lover's every action and character trait. Create the sense that this monotonous affection will go on forever. No more mystery, no more coquetry, no more retreats, just endless love. Few can endure such a threat. A few weeks of it, and they will be gone. Number 2. King Charles II of England was a devoted libertine. He kept a stable of lovers. There was always a favorite mistress from the aristocracy and countless other less important women. He craved variety. One evening in 1668, the king spent an evening at the theater, where he conceived a sudden desire for a young actress named Nell Gwynn. She was pretty and innocent-looking, only 18 at the time, with a girlish glow in her cheeks, but the lines she recited on stage were so impudent and saucy. Deeply excited, the king decided he had to have her. After the performance, he took her out for a night of drinking and merriment, then led her to his royal bed. Nell was the daughter of a fishmonger, and had begun by selling oranges in the theater. She rose to the status of actress by sleeping with writers and other theater men. She had no shame about this. When a footman of hers got into a fight with someone who said he worked for a whore, she broke it up by saying, "I am a whore. Find something better to fight about." Nell's humor and sass amused the king greatly, but she was low-born and an actress, and he could hardly make her a favorite. After several nights with pretty, witty Nell, he returned to his principal mistress, Louise de Kerouaille, a well-born Frenchwoman. Kerouaille was a clever seductress. She played hard to get and made it clear she wouldn't give the king her virginity until he had promised her a title. It was the kind of chase Charles enjoyed, and he made her the Duchess of Portsmouth. But soon her greed and difficultness began to wear on his nerves. To divert himself, he turned back to Nell. Whenever he visited her, he was royally entertained with food, drink, and her great good humor. The king was bored or melancholy, she took him drinking or gambling or out to the country, where she taught him to fish. She always had a pleasant surprise up her sleeve. What he loved most of all was her wit, the way she mocked the pretentious Kerouac. The Duchess had the habit of going into mourning whenever a nobleman of another country died, as if he were a relation. Nell, too, would show up at the palace on these occasions, dressed in black, and would sorrowfully say that she was mourning for the Sham of Tartary or the Boug of Oronuku, grand relatives of her own. To her face, she called the Duchess Squintabella and the Weeping Willow because of her simpering manners and melancholic airs. Soon the king was spending more time with Nell than with the Duchess. By the time Kerouac fell out of favor, Nell had, in essence, become the king's favorite, which she remained until his death in 1685. Interpretation. Nell Gwyn was ambitious. She wanted power and fame, but in the 17th century the only way a woman could get those things was through a man. And who better than the king? But to get involved with Charles was a dangerous game. A man like him, easily bored and in need of variety, would use her for a fling, then find someone else. Nell's strategy for the problem was simple. She let the king have his other girls and never complained. Every time he saw her, though, she made sure he was entertained and diverted. She filled his senses with pleasure, acting as if his position had nothing to do with her love for him. Variety in women could wear on the nerves, tiring a busy king. They all made so many demands. If one woman could provide the same variety, and Nell, as an actress, knew how to play different roles, she had a big advantage. Nell never asked for money, so Charles plied her with wealth. She never asked to be the favorite. How could she? She was a commoner. But he elevated her to the position. Many of your targets will be like kings and queens, particularly those who are easily bored. Once the seduction is over, they will not only have trouble idealizing you, they may also turn to another man or woman whose unfamiliarity seems exciting and poetic. Needing other people to divert them, they often satisfy this need through variety. Don't play into the hands of these bored royals by complaining, becoming self-pitying, or demanding privileges. That would only further their natural disenchantment once the seduction is over. Instead, make them see that you are not the person they thought you were. Make it a delightful game to play new roles, to surprise them, to be an endless source of entertainment. It's almost impossible to resist a person who provides pleasure with no strings attached. When they're with you, keep the spirit light and playful. Play up the parts of your character they find delightful, but never let them feel they know you too well. In the end, you will control the dynamic, and a haughty king or queen will become your abject slave. Number 3. When the great jazz composer Duke Ellington came to town, he and his band were always a big attraction, but especially so for the ladies of the area. They came to hear his music, of course. But once there, they were mesmerized by the Duke himself. On stage, Ellington was relaxed and elegant and seemed to be having such a good time. His face was very handsome and his bedroom eyes were infamous. He slept very little, and his eyes had permanent pouches under them. After the performance, some woman would inevitably invite him to her table, another would sneak into his dressing room, yet another would approach him on his way out. Duke made a point of being accessible, and when he kissed a woman's hand, his eyes and hers would meet for a moment. Sometimes she would signal an interest in him, and his glance in return would say he was more than ready. Sometimes his eyes were the first to speak. Few women could resist that look, even the most happily married. With the night's music still ringing in her ears, the woman would show up at Ellington's hotel room. He would be dressed in a stylish suit. He loved good clothes. And the room would be full of flowers. There would be a piano in the corner. He would play some music. His playing and his elegant, nonchalant manner would come across to the woman as pure theater, a pleasant continuation of the performance she had just witnessed. And when it was over, and Ellington had to leave town, he would give her a thoughtful gift. He would make it seem that the only thing taking him away from her was his touring. A few weeks later, the woman might hear a new Ellington song on the radio, with lyrics suggesting that she had inspired it. If ever he passed through the area again, she would find a way to be there, and Ellington would often renew the affair, if only for a night. Sometime in the 1940s, two young women from Alabama came to Chicago to attend a debutante ball. Ellington and his band were the entertainment. He was the women's favorite musician, and after the show they asked him for an autograph. He was so charming and engaging that one of the girls found herself asking what hotel he was staying at. He told them with a big grin. The girls switched hotels, and later that day they called up Ellington and invited him to their room for a drink. He accepted. They wore beautiful negligees that they had just bought. When Ellington arrived, he acted completely naturally, as if the warm greeting they gave him were completely usual. The three of them ended up in the bedroom, where one of the young women had an idea. Her mother adored Ellington. She had to call her now and put Ellington on the phone. Not at all put out by the suggestion, Ellington played along. For several minutes he talked to the mother on the telephone, lavishing her with compliments on the charming daughter she had raised, and telling her not to worry, he was taking good care of the girl. The daughter got back on the phone and said, "We're fine because we're with Mr. Ellington and he's such a perfect gentleman." As soon as she hung up, the three of them resumed the naughtiness they had started. To the two girls, it later seemed an innocent but unforgettable night of pleasure. Sometimes several of these far-flung mistresses would show up at the same concert. Ellington would go up and kiss each of them four times, a habit of his designed for just this dilemma. And each of the ladies would assume she was the one with whom the kisses really mattered. Interpretation. Duke Ellington had two passions, music and women. The two were interrelated. His endless affairs were a constant inspiration for his music. He also treated them as if they were theater, a work of art in themselves. When it came time to separate, he always managed it with a theatrical touch. A clever remark and a gift would make it seem that for him the affair was hardly over. Song lyrics referring to their night together would keep up the aesthetic atmosphere long after he had left town. No wonder women kept coming back for more. This wasn't a sexual affair, a tawdry one-nighter, but a heightened moment in the woman's life. And his carefree attitude made it impossible to feel guilty. Thoughts of one's mother or husband would not spoil the illusion. Ellington was never defensive or apologetic about his appetite for women. It was his nature, and never the fault of the woman, that he was unfaithful. And if he couldn't help his desires, how could she hold him responsible? It was impossible to hold a grudge against such a man or complain about his behavior. Ellington was an aesthetic rake, a type whose obsession with women can only be satisfied by endless variety. A normal man's tomcatting will eventually land him in hot water, but the aesthetic rake rarely stirs up ugly emotions. After he seduces a woman, there is neither an integration nor a sacrifice. He keeps them hanging and hoping. The spell is not broken the next day because the aesthetic rake makes the separation a pleasant, even elegant experience. The spell Ellington cast on a woman never went away. The lesson is simple. Keep the moments after the seduction and the separation in the same key as before. Heightened, aesthetic, and pleasant. If you don't act guilty for your feckless behavior, it's hard for the other person to feel angry or resentful. Seduction is a light-hearted game in which you invest all of your energy in the moment. The separation should be light-hearted and stylish as well. It's work, travel, some dreaded responsibility that calls you away. Create a memorable experience and then move on. And your victim will most likely remember the delightful seduction, not the separation. You will have made no enemies and will have a lifelong harem of lovers to whom you can always return when you feel so inclined. Number 4. In 1899, 20-year-old Baroness Frieda von Richthofen married an Englishman named Ernest Weekly, a professor at the University of Nottingham, and soon settled into the role of the professor's wife. Weekly treated her well, but she grew bored with their quiet life and his tepid lovemaking. On trips home to Germany, she had a few love affairs, but this wasn't what she wanted either, and so she returned to being faithful and caring for their three children. One day in 1912, a former student of Weekly's, David Herbert Lawrence, paid a visit to the couple's house. A struggling writer, Lawrence wanted the professor's professional advice. He was not home yet, so Frieda entertained him. She had never met such an intense young man. He talked of his impoverished youth, his inability to understand women, and he listened attentively to her own complaints. He even scolded her for the bad tea she had made him. Somehow, even though she was a baroness, this excited her. Lawrence returned for later visits, but now to see Frieda, not Weekly. One day he confessed to her that he had fallen deeply in love with her. She admitted to similar feelings and proposed they find a trysting spot. Instead, Lawrence had a proposal of his own. Leave your husband tomorrow. Leave him for me. What about the children? Frieda asked. If the children are more important than our love, Lawrence replied, then stay with them. But if you don't run away with me within a few days, you will never see me again. To Frieda, the choice was horrific. She did not care at all about her husband, but the children were what she lived for. Even so, a few days later, she succumbed to Lawrence's proposal. How could she resist a man who was willing to ask for so much, to take such a gamble? If she refused, she would always wonder, for such a man only passes once through your life. The couple left England and headed for Germany. Frieda would mention sometimes how much she missed her children, but Lawrence had no patience with her. You're free to go back to them at any moment, he would say, but if you stay, don't look back. He took her on an arduous mountaineering trip in the Alps. A baroness, she had never experienced such hardship, but Lawrence was firm. If two people are in love, why should comfort matter? In 1914, Frieda and Lawrence were married, but over the following years, the same pattern repeated. He would scold her for her laziness, the nostalgia for her children, her abysmal housekeeping. He would take her on trips around the world on very little money, never letting her settle down, although it was her fondest wish. They fought and fought. Once, in New Mexico, in front of friends, he yelled at her, "Take that dirty cigarette out of your mouth and stop sticking out that fat belly of yours." "You'd better stop that talk or I'll tell about your things," she yelled back. She had learned to give him a taste of his own medicine. They both went outside. Their friends watched, worried it might turn violent. They disappeared from sight, only to reappear moments later, arm in arm, laughing and mooning over one another. That was the most disconcerting thing about the Lawrences. Married for years, they often behaved like infatuated newlyweds. Interpretation. When Lawrence first met Frieda, he could sense right away what her weakness was. She felt trapped in a stultifying relationship and a pampered life. Her husband, like so many husbands, was kind but never paid enough attention to her. She craved drama and adventure but was too lazy to get it on her own. Drama and adventure were just what Lawrence would provide. Instead of feeling trapped, she had the freedom to leave him at any moment. Instead of ignoring her, He criticized her constantly. At least he was paying attention, never taking her for granted. Instead of comfort and boredom, he gave her adventure and romance. The fights he picked with ritualistic frequency also ensured non-stop drama and the space for a powerful reconciliation. He inspired a touch of fear in her, which kept her off balance, never quite sure of him. As a result, the relationship never grew stale. It kept renewing itself. If it's integration you're after, seduction must never stop. Otherwise, boredom will creep in. And the best way to keep the process going is often to inject intermittent drama. This can be painful, opening old wounds, stirring up jealousy, withdrawing a little. Don't confuse this behavior with nagging or carping criticism. This pain is strategic, designed to break up rigid patterns. On the other hand, it can also be pleasant. Think about proving yourself all over again, paying attention to nice little details, creating new temptations. In fact, you should mix the two aspects, for too much pain or pleasure will not prove seductive. You're not repeating the first seduction, for the target has already surrendered. You're simply supplying tiny jolts, little wake-up calls that show two things. You have not stopped trying, and they cannot take you for granted. The little jolt will stir up the old poison, stoke the embers, bring you temporarily back to the beginning when your involvement had a most pleasant freshness and tension. Remember, comfort and security are the death of seduction. A shared journey with a little bit of hardship will do more to create a deep bond than will expensive gifts and luxuries. The young are right to not care about comfort in matters of love, and when you return to that sentiment, a youthful spark will reignite. Number 5. In 1652, the famous French courtesan Ninon de L'Enclos met and fell in love with the Marquis de Villarceau. Ninon was a libertine. Philosophy and pleasure were more important to her than love. But the Marquis inspired new sensations. He was so bold, so impetuous, that for once in her life she let herself lose a little control. The Marquis was possessive, a trait she normally abhorred. But in him it seemed natural, almost charming. He simply couldn't help himself. And so Ninon accepted his conditions. There were to be no other men in her life. For her part, she told him that she would accept no money or gifts from him. This was to be about love, nothing else. She rented a house opposite his in Paris, and they saw each other daily. One afternoon, the Marquis suddenly burst in and accused her of having another lover. His suspicions were unfounded, his accusations absurd, and she told him so. This did not satisfy him, and he stormed out. The next day, Ninon received news that he'd fallen quite ill. She was deeply concerned. As a desperate recourse, a sign of her love and submission, she decided to cut off her beautiful long hair, for which she was famous, and send it to him. The gesture worked, the Marquis recovered, and they resumed their affair still more passionately. Friends and former lovers complained of her sudden transformation into the devoted woman, but she didn't care. She was happy. Now Ninon suggested that they go away together. The Marquis, a married man, could not take her to his chateau, but a friend offered his own in the country as a refuge for the lovers. Weeks became months, and their little stay turned into a prolonged honeymoon. Slowly, though, Ninon had the feeling that something was wrong. The Marquis was acting more like a husband. Although he was as passionate as before, he seemed so confident, as if he had certain rights and privileges that no other man could expect. The possessiveness that once had charmed her began to seem oppressive. Nor did he stimulate her mind. She could get other men, and equally handsome ones, to satisfy her physically without all that jealousy. Once this realization set in, Ninon wasted no time. She told the Marquis that she was returning to Paris and that it was over for good. He begged and pleaded his case with much emotion. How could she be so heartless? Although moved, Ninon was firm. Explanations would only make it worse. She returned to Paris and resumed the life of a courtesan. Her abrupt departure apparently shook up the Marquis, but apparently not too badly, for a few months later word reached her that he had fallen in love with another woman. Interpretation. A woman often spends months pondering the subtle changes in her lover's behavior. She might complain or grow angry. She might even blame herself. Under the weight of her complaints, the man may change for a while, but an ugly dynamic and endless misunderstandings will ensue. What is the point of all of this? Once you're disenchanted, it's really too late. Ninon could have tried to figure out what had disenchanted her, the good looks that now bored her, the lack of mental stimulation, the feeling of being taken for granted, but why waste time figuring it out? The spell was broken, so she moved on. She didn't bother to explain, to worry about de Villasseau's feelings, to make it all soft and easy for him. She simply left. The person who seems so considerate of the other, who tries to mend things or make excuses, is really just timid. Being kind in such matters can be rather cruel. The Marquis was able to blame everything on his mistress's heartless, fickle nature. His vanity and pride intact, he could easily move on to another affair and put her behind him. Not only does the long, lingering death of a relationship cause your partner needless pain, it will have long-term consequences for you as well, making you more skittish in the future and weighing you down with guilt. Never feel guilty, even if you were both the seducer and the one who now feels disenchanted. It's not your fault. Nothing can last forever. You have created pleasure for your victims, stirring them out of their rut. If you make a clean, quick break, in the long run, they will appreciate it. The more you apologize, the more you insult their pride, stirring up negative feelings that will reverberate for years. Spare them the disingenuous explanations that only complicate matters. The victim should be sacrificed, not tortured. Number 6. After 15 years under the rule of Napoleon Bonaparte, the French were exhausted. Too many wars, too much drama. When Napoleon was defeated in 1814 and was imprisoned on the island of Elba, the French were more than ready for peace and quiet. The Bourbons, the royal family deposed by the Revolution of 1789, returned to power. The king was Louis XVIII. He was fat, boring, and pompous. But at least there would be peace. Then, in February of 1815, news reached France of Napoleon's dramatic escape from Elba with 7 small ships and 1,000 men. He could head for America, start all over, but instead, he was just crazy enough to land at Cannes. What was he thinking? 1,000 men against all the armies of France? He set off toward Grenoble with his ragtag army. One, at least, had to admire his courage, his insatiable love of glory and of France. Then, too, the French peasantry were spellbound at the sight of their former emperor. This man, after all, had redistributed a great deal of land to them, which the new king was trying to take back. They swooned at the sight of his famous eagle standards, revivals of symbols from the Revolution. They left their fields and joined his march. Outside Grenoble, the first of the troops that the king sent to stop Napoleon caught up with him. Napoleon dismounted and walked on foot toward them. "Soldiers of the 5th Army Corps," he cried out, "don't you know me? If there is one among you who wishes to kill his emperor, let him come forward and do so. Here I am." He threw open his gray cloak, inviting them to take aim. There was a moment of silence, and then, from all sides, cries rang out of "Vive l'Empereur!" Long live the Emperor! In one stroke, Napoleon's army had doubled in size. The march continued. More soldiers, remembering the glory he had given them, changed sides. The city of Lyon fell without a battle. Generals with larger armies were dispatched to stop him, but the sight of Napoleon at the head of his troops was an overwhelmingly emotional experience for them, and they switched allegiance. King Louis fled France, abdicating in the process. On March 20th, Napoleon re-entered Paris and returned to the palace he had left only 13 months before, all without having had to fire a single shot. The peasantry and the soldiers had embraced Napoleon, but Parisians were less enthusiastic, particularly those who had served in his government. They feared the storms he would bring. Napoleon ruled the country for 100 days until the Allies and his enemies from within defeated him. This time, he was shipped off to the remote island of San Elena, where he was to die. Interpretation. Napoleon always thought of France and his army as a target to be wooed and seduced. As General de Segur wrote of Napoleon, "In moments of sublime power, he no longer commands like a man, but seduces like a woman." In the case of his escape from Elba, he planned a bold, surprising gesture that would titillate a bored nation. He began his return to France among the people who would be most receptive to him, the peasantry who had revered him. He revived the symbols, the revolutionary colors, the eagle standards that would stir up the old sentiments. He placed himself at the head of his army, daring his former soldiers to fire on him. The march on Paris that brought him back to power was pure theater, calculated for emotional effect every step of the way. What a contrast this former amour presented to the dolt of a king who now ruled them. Napoleon's second seduction of France was not a classical seduction, following the usual steps, but a re-seduction. It was built on old emotions and revived an old love. Once you have seduced a person, or a nation, there is almost always a lull, a slight letdown, which sometimes leads to a separation. It is surprisingly easy, though, to reseduce the same target. The old feelings never go away. They lie dormant, and in a flash, you can take your target by surprise. It is a rare pleasure to be able to relive the past, and one's youth to feel the old emotions. Like Napoleon, add a dramatic flair to your re-seduction. Revive the old images, the symbols, the expressions that will stir memory. Like the French, your targets will tend to forget the ugliness of the separation and will remember only the good things. You should make this second seduction bold and quick, giving your targets no time to reflect or wonder. Like Napoleon, play on the contrast to their current lover, making his or her behavior seem timid and stodgy by comparison. Not everyone will be receptive to a re-seduction, and some moments will be inappropriate. When Napoleon came back from Elba, the Parisians were too sophisticated for him and could see right through him. Unlike the peasants of the South, they already knew him well, and his re-entry came too soon. They were too worn out by him. If you want to re-seduce someone, choose one who doesn't know you so well, whose memories of you are cleaner, who is less suspicious by nature, and who is dissatisfied with present circumstances. Also, you might want to let some time pass. Time will restore your luster and make your faults fade away. Never see a separation or sacrifice as final. With a little drama and planning, a victim can be retaken in no time. Reversal. To keep a person enchanted, you will have to re-seduce them constantly. But you can allow a little familiarity to creep in. The target wants to feel that he or she is getting to know you. Too much mystery will create doubt. It will also be tiring for you, who will have to sustain it. The point is not to remain completely unfamiliar, but rather, on occasion, to jolt victims out of their complacency, surprising them as you surprised them in the past. Do this right, and they will have the delightful feeling that they're constantly getting to know more about you, but never too much. Appendix A. Seductive environment, seductive time. In seduction, your victims must slowly come to feel an inner change. Under your influence, they lower their defenses, feeling free to act differently, to be a different person. Certain places, environments, and experiences will greatly aid you in your quest to change and transform the seduced. Spaces with a theatrical, heightened quality, opulence, glittering surfaces, a playful spirit, create a buoyant, childlike feeling that make it hard for the victim to think straight. The creation of an altered sense of time has a similar effect. Memorable, dizzying moments that stand out, a mood of festival and play. You must make your victims feel that being with you gives them a different experience from being in the real world. Festival time and place. Centuries ago, life in most cultures was filled with work and routine, but at certain moments in the year, this life was interrupted by festival. During these festivals, Saturnalias of ancient Rome, the Maypole festivals of Europe, the great potlatches of the Chinook Indians, work in the fields or marketplace stopped. The entire tribe or town gathered in a sacred space set apart for the festival. Temporarily relieved of duty and responsibility, people were granted license to run amok. They would wear masks or costumes which gave them other identities, sometimes those of powerful figures reenacting the great myths of their culture. The festival was a tremendous release from the burdens of daily life. It altered people's sense of time, bringing moments in which they stepped outside of themselves. Time seemed to stand still. Something like this experience can still be found in the world's great surviving carnivals. The festival represented a break in a person's daily life, a radically different experience from routine. On a more intimate level, that is how you must envision your seductions. As the process advances, your targets experience a radical difference from daily life, a freedom from work or responsibility. Plunged into pleasure and play, they can act differently, can become someone else, as if they were wearing a mask. The time you spend with them is devoted to them and nothing else. Instead of the usual rotation of work and rest, you are giving them grand, dramatic moments that stand out. You bring them to places unlike the places they see in daily life, heightened, theatrical places. Physical environment strongly affects people's moods. A place dedicated to pleasure and play insinuates thoughts of pleasure and play. When your victims return to their duties and to the real world, they feel the contrast strongly, and they'll start to crave that other place into which you've drawn them. What you're essentially creating is festival time and place. Moments when the real world stops and fantasy takes over. Our culture no longer supplies such experiences, and people yearn for them. That is why almost everyone is waiting to be seduced, and why they will fall into your arms if you play this right. The following are key components to reproducing festival time and place. Create theatrical effects. Theater creates a sense of a separate magical world. The actor's makeup, the fake but alluring sets, the slightly unreal costumes, these heightened visuals, along with the story of the play, create illusion. To produce this effect in real life, you must fashion your clothes, makeup, and attitude to have a playful, artificial edge, a feeling that you have dressed for the pleasure of your audience. This is the goddess-like effect of a Marlene Dietrich, or the fascinating effect of a dandy like Beau Brummel. Your encounters with your targets should also have a sense of drama, achieved through the settings you choose and through your actions. The target shouldn't know what will happen next. Create suspense through twists and turns that lead to the happy ending. You are performing. Whenever your targets meet you, they're returned to this vague feeling of being in a play. You both have the thrill of wearing masks, of playing a different role from the one your life has allotted you. Use the visual language of pleasure. Certain kinds of visual stimuli signal that you're not in the real world. You want to avoid images that have depth, which might provoke thought or guilt. Instead, you should work in environments that are all surface, full of glittering objects, mirrors, pools of water, a constant play of light. The sensory overload of these spaces creates an intoxicating, buoyant feeling. The more artificial, the better. Show your targets a playful world, full of the sights and sounds that excite the baby or child within them. Luxury, the sense that money has been spent or even wasted, adds to the feeling that the real world of duty and morality has been banished. Call it the brothel effect. Keep it crowded or close. People crowding together raise the psychological temperature to hothouse levels. Festivals and carnivals depend on the contagious feeling a crowd creates. Bring your target to such environments sometimes to lower their normal defensiveness. Similarly, any kind of situation that brings people together in a small space for a long period of time is extremely conducive to seduction. For years, Sigmund Freud had a small, tight-knit stable of disciples who attended his private lectures and who engaged in an astonishing number of love affairs. Either lead the seduced into a crowded, festival-like environment, or go trolling for targets in a closed world. Manufacture mystical effects. Spiritual or mystical effects distract people's minds from reality, making them feel elevated and euphoric. From here, it's but a small step to physical pleasure. Use whatever props are at hand, astrology books, angelic imagery, mystical-sounding music from some far-off culture. The great 18th-century Austrian charlatan Franz Mesmer filled his salons with harp music, the perfume of exotic incense, and a female voice singing in a distant room. On the walls, he put stained glass and mirrors. His dupes would feel relaxed, uplifted, and as they sat in the room where he used magnets for their healing powers, they would feel a kind of spiritual tingling pass from body to body. Anything vaguely mystical helps block out the real world, and it's easy to move from the spiritual to the sexual. Distort their sense of time, speed, and youth. Festival time has a kind of speed and frenzy that make people feel more alive. Seduction should make the heart beat faster so that the seduced loses track of time passing. Take them to places of constant activity and movement. Embark with them on some kind of journey together, distracting their minds with new sights. Youth may fade and disappear, but seduction brings the feeling of being young no matter the age of those involved. And youth is mostly energy. The pace of the seduction must pick up at a certain moment, creating a whirling effect in the mind. It's no wonder that Casanova did much of his seducing at balls, or that the waltz was the preferred tool of many a 19th-century rake. Create moments. Everyday life is a drudgery in which the same actions endlessly repeat. The festival, on the other hand, we remember as a moment when everything was transformed, when a little bit of eternity and myth entered our lives. Your seduction must have such peaks, moments when something dramatic happens and time is experienced differently. You must give your targets such moments, whether by staging the seduction in a place, a carnival, a theater, where they naturally occur, or by creating them yourself with dramatic actions that stir up strong emotions. Those moments should be pure leisure and pleasure. No thoughts of work or morality can intrude. Madame de Pompadour, the mistress of King Louis XV, had to re-seduce her easily bored lover every few months. Intensely creative, she devised parties, balls, games, a little theater at Versailles. The seduced revels in affairs like this, sensing the effort you've expended to divert and enchant them. Scenes from Seductive Time and Place. Number 1. Around the year 1710, a young man whose father was a prosperous wine dealer in Osaka, Japan, found himself daydreaming more and more. He worked night and day for his father, and the burden of family life and all of its duties was oppressive. Like every young man, he had heard of the pleasure districts of the city, the quarters where the normally strict laws of the shogunate could be violated. It was here that you would find the ukiyo, the floating world of transient pleasures, a place where actors and courtesans ruled. This was what the young man was daydreaming about. Biding his time, he managed to find an evening when he could slip out unnoticed. He headed straight for the pleasure quarters. This was a cluster of buildings, restaurants, exclusive clubs, tea houses, that stood out from the rest of the city by their magnificence and color. The moment the young man stepped into it, he knew he was in a different world. Actors wandered the streets in elaborately dyed kimonos. They had such manners and attitudes as if they were still on stage. The streets bustled with energy. The pace was fast. Bright lanterns stood out against the night, as did the colorful posters for the nearby Kabuki Theater. The women had a completely different air about them. They stared at him brazenly, acting with the freedom of a man. He caught sight of an onagata, one of the men who played female roles in the theater, a man more beautiful than most women he had seen, and whom the passers-by treated like royalty. The young man saw other young men like himself entering a tea house, so he followed them in. Here, the highest class of courtesans, the great Tayus, plied their trade. A few minutes after the young man sat down, he heard a noise and bustle, and down the stairs came a few of the Tayus, followed by musicians and jesters. The women's eyebrows were shaved, replaced by a thick black painted line. Their hair was swept up in a perfect fold, and he had never seen such beautiful kimonos. The Tayus seemed to float across the floor, using different kinds of steps, suggestive, creeping, cautious, etc., depending on whom they were approaching and what they wanted to communicate to him. They ignored the young man. He had no idea how to invite them over, but he noticed that some of the older men had a way of bantering with them that was a language all its own. The wine began to flow, music was played, and finally some lower-level courtesans came in. By then the young man's tongue was loosened. These courtesans were much friendlier, and the young man began to lose all track of time. Later he managed to stagger home, and only the next morning did he realize how much money he'd spent. If father ever found out... Yet a few weeks later, he was back. Like hundreds of such sons in Japan whose stories filled the literature of the period, he was on the path towards squandering his father's wealth on the floating world. Seduction is another world into which you initiate your victims. Like the ukiyo, it depends on a strict separation from the day-to-day world. When your victims are in your presence, the outside world, with its morality, its codes, its responsibilities, is banished. Anything is allowed, particularly anything normally repressed. The conversation is lighter and more suggestive. Clothes and places have a touch of theatricality. The license exists to act differently, to be someone else, without any heaviness or judging. It is a kind of concentrated, psychological, floating world that you create for the others, and it becomes addictive. When they leave you and return to their routines, they are doubly aware of what they're missing. The moment they crave the atmosphere you have created, the seduction is complete. As in the floating world, money is to be wasted. Generosity and luxury go hand in hand with a seductive environment. Number 2. It began in the early 1960s. People would come to Andy Warhol's New York studio, soak up the atmosphere, and stay a while. Then, in 1963, the artist moved into a new Manhattan space, and a member of his entourage covered some of the walls and pillars in tinfoil and spray-painted a brick wall and other things.